This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, Whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more five-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain.
As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today.
Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. I'm Michael Sacca.
I'm Joelle Steiniger.
And I'm Matt Goldman.
And we're having 20-minute talks with entrepreneurs teaching you how to launch your product into revenue.
Check out our book at howtobuildarocketship.com to reserve your launch discount and to download a free chapter.
In this podcast, we talk with Scott Chisholm, a co-founder of Stay Classy. We talked about his unusual route to raising 1.5 million seed over the course of 2 years, and how mentors and advisors help them grow into one of the biggest nonprofit donation platforms in the world. Stay tuned. I think you're really going to enjoy this one.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a minute to thank CodeShip for sponsoring the show. CodeShip makes continuous deployment simple and easy. And we've actually been happy customers of theirs for a very long time. You should go to codeship.io/rocketship to check out videos and tutorials all about how you can start using CodeShip to deploy your product in a better way.
We'd also like to thank Invision App. Invision is by far the best prototyping and collaboration tool on the market. I can personally say I can't imagine delivering another design comp without it. It made collaborating with our entire team incredibly easy, and the annotation tool alone saved us hours of back and forth. Go to envisionapp.com/rocketship and sign up to get their starter plan free for 90 days. This comes complete with unlimited screens and unlimited collaborators. Trust me, this is an essential tool for teams of all sizes.
Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. We're here with Scott, one of the co-founders of Stay Classy. Scott, welcome.
How are you guys doing?
Good, good. So for those that may not know, tell us what Stay Classy does. Stay Classy is an online fundraising platform specifically designed for nonprofits and social enterprises. So you can think of it sort of like WordPress is to a website, Stay Classy is to a nonprofit's fundraising operation. So we're kind of like the behind-the-scenes technology that allows them to launch crowdfunding campaigns, events, and integrate deeply into their website to sort of build a fundraising and supporter community.
Very cool. Very cool. So where did you guys find this problem and kind of come up with the solution?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we didn't start with an epiphany moment, if you will. We didn't wake up one day and say, wow, it'd be great to start selling software to nonprofits. The company's story started with really, really humble beginnings. It was myself and a group of my roommates in Mission Bay.
Okay.
Sitting in an apartment that was, you know, way too dirty and with beer in front of us and whatnot. And we had an epiphany over a few beers that, you know, each person in the house had essentially been touched by cancer. Someone in their family had either breast cancer, or in the case of my friend Pete, his father had passed away from cancer. And we sort of had this moment where we realized maybe we should stop being degenerates and we should actually go out and do something for the cancer cause. So we sort of brainstormed, and our genius idea was to host a pub crawl for charity for the American Cancer Society. And the origin of the name, the company name, stems into the story as well. The movie Anchorman happened to be on in the background as we were coming up with the idea for the pub crawl. And my friend Pete turned and said, "Well, why don't we name it Stay Classy?" Right as Ron Burgundy in the movie was saying, "You stay classy, San Diego." Never in a million years thinking that this would actually turn into a legitimate organization. And now, you know, 7 years later, we're still called Stay Classy. And the origin of the company is from Anchorman. So, you know, we hosted that pub crawl. We raised $1,000 for the ACS. We were inspired to do more fundraising events. So, you know, I was working full-time at Booz Allen Hamilton doing management consulting, and all my roommates were full-time with other jobs. And basically this became a passion project, just hosting, you know, charity fundraising events. Started with the cancer cause, but, you know, eventually moved into the environment, Surf Rider, veterans support with Warrior, et cetera, et cetera. And until we were supporting dozens of different organizations, hosting huge fundraising events. The biggest one we hosted was a 5,000-person music festival in Mission Bay with headliner Mattis Yahoo, Mason Jennings, Bass Nectar, before anyone knew who Bass Nectar was. And the bass from Bass Nectar's subwoofers literally was like waking like grandmothers up across the bay. And they banned all music events in Mission Bay after our concert. We ended up raising like, I think, $20,000 for San Diego Youth Services. It was a youth homeless shelter that they were building. So it was a success from that standpoint. Yeah. But unfortunately, no one else is able to host concerts on the bay due to our
So how did you guys transition from events into kind of an online platform?
Yeah, totally. So, you know, along the way, as our events started getting more sophisticated and bigger, we realized that we couldn't use sort of the ticketing and the fundraising stuff that we had been using up to date. Like, we had built like a band-aid solution with like Evite, PayPal, MySpace at the time, and Facebook.
Sure, yeah.
And basically we were doing like an early version of crowdfunding essentially tied to our events. So people would come to the event, they'd buy a ticket, and then they'd have to go raise some money. Okay. And they were just sending a PayPal link out essentially. Mm-hmm. So we decided that wasn't, you know, sufficient anymore. And so we hired a developer, literally cold called like a guy. We were engineers, but not software engineers.
Okay.
And he came in and built like the alpha version of Stay Classy for our own events. So the $20,000 we raised from that music concert, the Mattis Yahoo show, mm-hmm. Was raised on the alpha version of Stay Classy.
Oh, nice.
So we didn't really have the intention to commercialize it, but then some of the nonprofit beneficiaries of our events said, "Hey, you know, we're paying like thousands of dollars a year for a product that's not even as good as this like alpha thing that you just built. Like, why don't you let us use this?"
Okay.
And so basically we let some of our clients use it, got some feedback through there. It's just a slow rolling process. Eventually we said, okay, we're onto something here. Like, you know, we understood the market a little bit better over time, started to understand the unique challenges of nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. Crowdfunding started to get hot around the same time. This is like 2009, 2010. Kickstarter had literally just launched as well. And so, you know, we thought that our strength was understanding the unique challenges of nonprofit organizations. So we built basically a fundraising platform that was specifically dedicated to that vertical, and it's worked out. I mean, it certainly nice.
has had its trials and tribulations, but now we're about 45 people strong. We've raised some decent money, and we're growing pretty fast. So it's been a long ass journey.
So let's talk a little bit about how you guys have kind of built an advisory board around, where do you guys get your mentorship from in order to grow to a company of this size?
Yeah. So, in the early days, we people told us, hey, you need to build an advisory board and whatnot. And we just, when we started, we literally had like no network at all. Like, we were first time entrepreneurs. And we're more or less clueless. I think we had some business acumen, of course, but, we really had no idea, what it was like to start a company. And so everyone's like, oh, you have to build an advisory board. And so basically we picked out of a hat. Like, we had no idea who we were picking. And we ended up with this really random advisory board, like guys that, were really smart and maybe they had, run companies and stuff, but they were just totally, didn't make sense at all to advise our type of company.
Okay.
They came from down here in biotech space, so like they're like biotech executive. What does he know about running like a startup software company? We had ages to go before any advice that guy could really give would be useful.
Right.
And no offense to him, it just didn't make sense at the time. So I think we got better at picking our advisory board, and we looked to basically build a combination of people that had direct nonprofit experience, so people that worked for nonprofits that could help inform us on their challenges and stuff, and continue to feed into the product roadmap, and then people that just were really good at like business and SaaS and software. Heaton Shaw is now one of our advisors. Dan Martell is one of our advisors. Alex Bard is one of our advisors, and those guys have built multi entrepreneurs. They run businesses and stuff, and they've had their own sets of challenges and they've gone through it. So finding someone that basically has been where you're at, but maybe only a few years ahead of you, I think is a lot better than someone that maybe is like at the tail end of their career and has been an executive of like a Fortune 500 company. Like, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be more connected, especially in the early days, so that the advice they're giving you is relevant to your stage sector as well.
When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination.
So someone like, Heaton is incredibly busy.
Yeah.
How do you get someone like that to, advise and maybe give us a little insight into what that relationship looks like?
Yeah. I actually didn't even know. Alex Bard, I don't know if you know who Alex Bard is, but he started desk.com and it was sold to Salesforce for about $80 million. He's on his third company. That was his third company. And he's like a really good SaaS CEO. And he's the one who introduced me to Heaton, but I didn't know Heaton originally. I just followed him on Twitter.
Okay.
And so, just like probably 100,000 other people that are
follow Heaton on Twitter.
Yeah, it's like, I was like, it'd be really cool to have Heaton as an advisor. And again, we're down in San Diego. Like, he's really, really popular within the San Francisco crowds and definitely outside of San Francisco as well, but really popular in San Francisco. And so I was like, you know, I didn't even think that he would necessarily listen. But, you know, just like in our early attempts at raising money, more or less it comes down to personal introductions, like everything. So Alex just asked him on the side if he would be okay with the introduction. And so he introduced me and Heaton, and we just jumped on a call. And actually, the founding story and the connection to the cancer cause resonated with him.
Oh, nice.
So he was like booked up, and he has like a, he has very strict rules for himself as how many bullets is on and things like that. And so we snuck in there somehow, which is good timing. So yeah, I think we got kind of lucky. And you know, we were also at a stage where I don't know what his portfolio of sort of advisory companies looks like, but. I think we were at a stage where we were like right about to sort of hit a good wave of growth, and he could tell that. Like, we were right at that point where his experience with customer acquisition, specifically B2B stuff, would be relevant.
Okay.
We were earlier on, it'd be all about getting product market fit and some of the other stuff, but we had just sort of, we had already kind of gone through that first couple phases, and we were at the point where we were looking, really looking at the business model, fine tuning the sales and marketing strategy, and continue to experiment down that road.
Okay.
And that's actually what attracted Dan too, Dan Martel. And so those both those guys are really good with acquisition. So they were, you know, excited.
So you
were
kind of sharing your growth with them?
Absolutely.
Through emails, or did you go and meet with them?
No, on the phone actually. I didn't.
Okay.
Keaton signed up before I even met him in person.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's cool.
And then I went up and we had tea at the I think it's the Buena Vista like tea center or something up there on like a hill. And he also taught me how to drink tea properly, because I was apparently just screwing up all the rules.
Yeah.
So I had known Dan through different entrepreneurial events and stuff. But yeah, he came on at the same time as he.
Cool.
So it was kind of like, I think it's just a mix of who's within a couple degrees of separation for you, who's like the best person that you could possibly get within your sort of immediate network. Go after that person, like bring some credibility. I mean, as silly as it is, I mean, people operate off social proof. When it comes down, advisory boards are the same as investments. Of, you know, the fact that he knew that Alex was involved was a big deal.
Okay.
You know, he's vouching for us, essentially, softly vouching for us, just
right.
by being involved. And, you know, our advisory board now, it speaks volumes to the investors and other stuff like that. So
okay.
It does make a huge difference. You don't have to rush and get, you know, build an advisory board in a month. I would actually recommend just, you know, taking it slow and sort of figuring out who's that the best person that's closest to you. Get that person involved first. Get them really excited about what you're doing, and then sort of have that person help you branch out from there.
Cool. And is it like a
So what's the relationship like with your advisors, and how do you make the most use of the advice that they have to give? Do you set up like, you know, monthly meetings? Is it more just whenever you meet them, you pick up the phone and call?
Mm-hmm. That's something I'm still trying to optimize, to be honest with you. It's not easy because everyone's super busy.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that, you know, in the earlier days, a higher touch relationship can be helpful, but it can burn out the relationship a little bit. So you just have to be really, really sensitive to everyone's time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do now, and again, in the earlier days, it probably would have been smarter to do more frequent meeting. But now we do a quarterly call. And honestly, it's more of like, hey, if I have a question, I just call them up. I don't even think I've had a formal quarterly. That's like what it says in our advisory board agreement. I don't even think we've had quarterly calls,
okay.
really. So, I mean, you put some structure in place so there's an expectation, but really what ends up happening is like you have a problem and then they just make themselves available, which is that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And then we try to do a meeting with the advisory board just once a year. So we have a leadership offsite coming up, and it's actually at the Movember office in LA. The guys who grow the mustaches and raise tons of money.
Oh, there's an office for that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's
they
amazing.
Raise $150 million a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're at client leaders?
No, actually, they built their own fundraising platform before we existed.
Okay.
But Adam Garoni, the global CEO, is on our board. Like
cool.
The board of directors. He started on our advisory board though. So he was someone from the nonprofit space that we brought in that was like, wow, this guy's raising $150 million through personal fundraising globally. He would have some insights that we could learn from. And so we brought him on, and then we developed a really close relationship with him, and he ended up inviting him to the board of directors, which is awesome. So anyways, we're having this leadership offsite at his office. So all of our, you know, management team, whatever, will go there, and then all of our advisors will fly out, and they'll partake in this, which is really cool. It's the first year we've actually done it like that.
Nice.
In the beginning, it was more just myself and my co-founder, Pat, meeting these guys individually. We'd fly to San Francisco if we're in town. Hey, let's get coffee. Let's talk about X, Y, and Z. And we would typically send them an email with one question or one topic, try to guide it as much as possible. And in the really early days, we tried to set up that official quarterly call, almost like acting like it was a board meeting, and sent us 100 slide deck that was useless. And everyone just sat there listening to us. And then by the end, we're like, yeah, I don't know how much we got out of it. Maybe you should just come with some targeted questions. We don't really care about all this other stuff.
Right.
So we kind of learned. So, it's and also too, each person, it's good if you're thinking about them from a specialty perspective. So Heaton and Dan Martell are sort of in the acquisition realm. They both have, unique skill sets within there. But Alex Barn, I lean to a lot for leadership and just general CEO stuff. Adam Garoni from Movember is amazing at company culture and vision and mapping out your mission, because it comes from the social space. So if you kind of write down what type of advisor you want for your specialty, and then sort of try to find that person over time, but don't rush it.
Okay.
That's a good way of looking at it. And then plan your outreach to them or your interaction based on their specialty. So the leadership offset I was talking about is cool, because it's sort of we're touching everything, but maybe you have a monthly customer acquisition meeting with your management team or your co-founder or whoever, and you bring in one advisor to sit in and listen.
Sure.
So it's unique to every person, but I think you can get creative with it, so you're not just sitting all the advisors on a call just listening to you pitch a deck. That doesn't really do anything.
So how early did you start to even go after the process of finding an advisor? Was this pre-funding? Was this pre-product market fit?
Actually, right when we were raising money initially. So we went through an incubator here in town called Springboard. It's one of the earliest ones. And one of our advisors actually invested the first $100,000 in State Classy, which was pretty awesome. And right around that time, after we were taking $100,000, we were using that to essentially try to build out. We rebuilt State Classy after we had built that alpha version. So we basically rebuilt it from scratch, used the $100,000 to do that, bring on Pete, our VP of engineering still.
Okay.
He was the first coder. Bring him on full time. And then we started looking at, what do we have to prove out? What are the milestones we have to achieve in the next six, eight months? And, what type of money are we going to need to hit those milestones and beyond? And so coming back to full circle to your question, right when we started mapping out the milestones and the financing, we started paying a lot more attention to the advisory board, because we knew that from a social proof perspective, we didn't have a ton of traction yet. So we thought that the advisory board would help give us some credibility with investors. I think it did to some degree. We picked some weird ones in the beginning. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were in one investor meeting and they looked at the advisory board and they're like, I don't understand your advisory board. Not kidding. Yeah, it was with Tech Coast Angels.
Okay.
Needless to say, they didn't invest.
they don't a lot.
Yeah. I'm glad they didn't.
I'd love to dig into your funding a little bit, because
sure.
We constantly read about, your seed round is 12 to 18 months, $250,000 to $500K. You guys did it much different than the typical funding. And it could be because you're in San Diego, or maybe you guys just saw something different. So I'd love to hear a little bit about how you ended up raising. It was almost $5 million.
Yep. Seven million total
angel investors, right?
$7 million total, $5 million from angel investors. The so part of it's definitely because we were in San Diego, and there's not a well established network of investors down here that at least you can tap into. Tech Coast Angels and some other groups like that are the only ones, and they're not necessarily investing in the same in SaaS software companies all the time. I think in the very, very early days, our strategy was hey, let's just get in front of anyone that has money that will listen to us.
Sure.
We started to find a niche. First guy to invest was the $100,000 from our advisor, or the incubator.
Okay.
And then he actually ended up joining the advisory board as well. That's why I said that. And then we went to, we kind of went out and tried to raise money from more guys like him, and it wasn't very successful. So I resorted back to family and friends. Mm-hmm. So I went backwards. got like, you know, another, say, total of $100,000.
Okay.
So we had like $200,000. And we did this, the early days was set up outside of that initial $100,000. That was actually in equity. And then the next $1.5 million was all on a convertible note. And it was, it took two to two and a half years to fill the note up. So we just raised it in chunks. Like, it's because we just, like, we didn't have a network. So in the beginning, we were just fine. Okay, here's who, this guy can invest $50,000. Awesome. We'll keep the lights on. Okay, this guy can invest $25,000. At one point, you know, someone had committed $20,000 or $50,000. And we were like 3 days away from payroll. And we had, you know, we only had like probably five guys on staff. And we had never missed a payroll. And in fact, that's the only time that we've ever been late. And we were way late by one day. We drove up to LA to find the lawyer of the investor who was delaying the process. And literally, we're just going to go knock on his door and be like, dude, what is going on? Like, just figure it out. Like, yeah.
How does that work when you're, like, how do you raise that much on a convertible note for those that aren't familiar? What does that look like in the negotiation process?
Yeah, so, you know, convertible notes are a lot more popular even now in the last 3 years than they were when we were doing it, like, probably four or five years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they've become, there's a set of standard terms, essentially, that are involved with that. And for those people that don't know what convertible note is, I mean, essentially, it's a loan that automatically converts into equity at a later date. And typically, the investors, the reason why they would put money on a convertible note is because they'll get some sort of discount. So when it does convert, say if everyone's converting at $1 a share, they get it at 80 cents a share or something like that.
Okay.
And so that's one of the terms that you negotiate. So like the discount upon conversion is a big one. Interest, so while they're waiting for it to convert, they get some sort of interest. That could be like as low as 3%. It could be as high as 10%. I think it's like the legal limit. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at other investments and saying, okay, well, you know, I'm getting some interest. But it's obviously high risk because it's still very high risk because they don't know if it's actually going to convert. Because there needs to be a certain amount raised before it actually converts into equity.
Okay.
So there's all sorts of, you know, little, you know, details there and stuff.
And did you guys have a number that you were kind of like
so that,
raising for everyone?
So that's the thing. Like, we were doing this so early that we had no cap and basically, like, you know, practically no discount. So,
okay.
We just didn't even know what we were doing. And like, our lawyer gave us like the most company friendly note ever. And we just went out and sold it.
And it worked. Though.
Yeah, it worked. Like, no one knew any better. We didn't know any better. They didn't know any better. So it kind of worked out. Ultimately, we ended up getting a really good deal because it converted at a fair. We ended up auto converting it into a fair valuation.
Okay.
And then, you know, we ended up going on to raise more money and the company's grown. So it worked out. Like, they're excited about it, but you would never find a note like that in today's day.
Okay.
I do some angel investing on the side, and like, it's pretty strict about exactly what the cap is and stuff on the conversion. And I always laugh at what we pulled off. We didn't even know what we're doing. No clue. So, you know, it ended up being, I think, a fair deal, but it could have been a lot more, you know, quote unquote, investor friendly in the early days. But it gave us the wiggle room, actually, because there wasn't a timeline associated with it. More or less, it gave us wiggle room to figure our shit out. Like, we, you know, if we've been forced, I think with a timeline that was too strict, I think it might have broken the company, to be honest. It allowed us to raise it in chunks and like just really sort of figure things out in intervals, rather than just bringing in, you know, we didn't even have the luxury to bring in like $1 million at a time or something. Mm-hmm. But even if we had, I'm not sure what we would have done with $1 million.
Okay.
We had a lot to figure out, a lot to prove.
That's really interesting, because I was just going to ask you, like, if you could do it again, would you do it more in like one sprint or two sprints versus this long, drawn out raising process, just purely because it takes so much of your time and energy to be out there trying to raise?
Well, it's hugely distracting. I wouldn't change anything about how we did it, because I think it was crucial to our learning process.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to do another company, I definitely would not have done it like that. But that's just because I think I've learned a lot, and certainly in a second company, there'd be a whole new set of learnings. But you know, sort of the more administrative, like, how do you start a company stuff that everyone figures out when they're starting out. You know, we've at least got that under our belt now, so it'd be different. And I think we have a lot more credibility with investors, so we'd be able to raise in bigger chunks. And again, you're weighing like the trade-off between the time it takes to actually fundraise and dilution and other factors that you consider. So I think if I were to, I wouldn't change anything about how we did Stay Classy. If I would do it again, I'd raise, you know, probably, you know, $500 to $1 million to start as a seed round, just to get some good people around me. And then I would, you know, raise a Series A that was pretty sizable, but I would wait to raise a Series A until we had clearly achieved product market fit and you know, hit some milestones and prove some traction. Just because I don't want to, I mean, frankly, it's more of like a personal reason. I don't want to waste people's money.
Yeah.
I actually care about making our shareholders money and doing what we say we're going to do. Like, I actually hate the concept of a zombie startup. I cannot stand it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I feel like it's such a cop-out. You raise a bunch of money and then you're like, oh, well, we tried.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I guess, you know, it just wasn't growing fast enough. We'll try freaking harder. You just raise people's money, you know, like, just don't raise money if you're not going to do that, you know. So I tie myself really closely to the shareholders. I care a lot about it. And I think that, you know, if we had had that attitude that, oh, it's not growing fast enough, we would have killed this company like 10 times.
Okay.
I'm glad we haven't.
Yeah.
It's absolutely still growing, and it's growing much faster now than it was before. But I think it ebbs and flows, and it's like you're never going to just like figure it out. I mean, even the companies that appear like overnight successes, there's usually 7 years of back history and challenges that they've gone through just to get to where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's the anomaly, like Instagram or something, but yeah, that's like 0.0001% of all companies. So
yeah.
I just the idea of the zombie startup and like people that don't really understand the context around that, coming into it with that attitude, I think is like the wrong way to go. And partly, you know, lean startups to blame for that. And I love lean startup, but the mentality of like being able to assess something quickly and make a decision. Well, you can't always do that, especially, you know, you can test a button and say, okay, this button's going to convert better on page X by using analytics, but you can't always do the same with business. You can't just say like, oh, we're going to give it like, you know, 2 months. And if we get X users because of X, Y, Z, that means it's ultimately going to be a success. If it isn't, then it's not going to be a success. That's just not true necessarily.
Yeah.
And I think it's more complicated than that. It comes down to the people, comes down to the market, comes down to a lot of different factors. And I think you got to really assess, you know, all of those things before making a judgment call and to kill something. And so anyways, I think like, you know, from a fundraising strategy, we had enough to keep going, but not enough to overspend or be reckless. And
sure.
So we were essentially forced to grow and think through important decisions with, you know, parameters and some constraints, I guess. And don't they say, someone said, you know, constraints breed innovation and all that stuff. So it's kind of like the same. I think it's very similar. If you're just given like $40 million, you're like, oh, let's just like let's throw a bunch of shit against the wall and see what happens. So, you know, we never had more than, I think, $500,000 in the bank account ever for like years. Until we built up our own revenue.
Where was most of that early money spent? Were you like very heavy on dev in the beginning, or did you go, as soon as you kind of figured out your fit, were you just dumping money into like sales and acquisition?
Yeah.
How'd that break down?
Well, I bought a Tesla when that came out. it was spent mostly on dev. It was mostly spent on dev. It was really, we were like, we still are very product oriented. In fact, like I didn't have, you know, we're engineers by trade and stuff. I'm an industrial engineer. So like more of like a process engineer. So, I was doing a lot of the UX and stuff in the early days and, you know, loved like the process flows and all that stuff. And so just generally like our culture ended up being very product oriented, and not sales and marketing oriented at all in the beginning. And so, you know, it took us years to figure out our sales and marketing strategy. I mean, so we were like, we had like this, you know, what we thought was this kick-ass product which people love. We're like, why don't we have
where are they? Right.
And so it literally grew by word of mouth and inbound marketing for the first many years. We actually just spent our first dollar on paid advertising this quarter.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. So it's all been, and actually that was another great like lesson, because we started writing blogs when we were talking about fundraising and we're talking about our product and we're talking about all these different things. And now it's like one of the most popular nonprofit blogs in the whole entire sector.
Wow.
And we get hundreds of leads a day through that blog still. And we do all sorts of stuff like webinars and do all these things. But that was like out of necessity because we didn't have money. So that's free. It's just, right. I mean, it's free. You have to pay for the salary, but and a lot of that was before we were paying ourselves. So we started to build up authority in the space and became a thought leader. That's invaluable. It takes a long time, but I mean, if you can even carve out like 10% of your time, you're just like, you know, the morning on a Sunday or a weekend or something, just dedicated to like content creation and thought leadership, on your blog, webinars, potentially podcasts, writing answers on Quora, things like that are really invaluable. And we still get tons of leads on Quora. I spent like a year trying to build some authority on there and literally get visits all the time from Quora.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's cool.
We've talked to a couple of people who have done that same strategy and they said it's just a long tail. Yeah.
It's so hard to do. Like in the beginning, the first 6 months through the first year, you'll look back and be like, did that do anything?
Yeah.
And it does end up working in the most weird ways. At first it's like, oh, you know, like you'll get on the phone with someone or whatever and they'll say, oh, I heard you about somewhere, and then it'll come out, it was a Quora article they read. Or it isn't always like it isn't always traceable, I guess.
Okay.
Saying. Especially in the earlier days, like you don't really know what it's doing, but you just have to have faith that it is doing something and it does have a net positive. I mean, people like people that have an opinion, have a stance, put stuff out there. I think that's hugely important. And we could have even been louder. I think we were doing it right, but we weren't loud enough. Now we're very loud. And now what's even cooler is the paid advertising strategy is totally built on the content creation. So we're not going out with paid ads and saying like, sign up and buy our software. We're like, hey, here's this awesome new guide we just published on fundraising psychology.
Okay.
They download it and it's locked behind a lead form, and we get them basically interested. We put them on our newsletter list and everything else, and they start to receive content on a weekly basis. So even that is actually a little bit of a longer play than just like forcing it down their throat. But we're supplementing now paid advertising to give it a little bit of a boost.
Okay.
And accelerate the process a little bit. But in the early days, that wasn't even necessary.
It's interesting, and it's the same funnel that you've probably optimized, I assume,
exactly.
Right now through content.
Exactly.
And now the money is probably being used very efficiently.
Exactly. The only difference is that we have theorized that, okay, if we're going to pay something, then we should probably follow up with them a little bit earlier in the process, just so that we can like measure it to make sure there's an ROI there versus like 2 years later being like, remember that money we spent on that, those paid ads? Like, but besides that, it's the same nurturing tracks. Like, you know, if we get on the phone with them, they're still on the same email nurturing tracks and whatever else. And we'll just say like, hey, what'd you think of the guide? We don't even say like, it's just, you know, they're going to know, for the most part, they're going to know that you have a product, most likely. Not everyone does, but as long as you don't try to force it down their throat. You build a healthy relationship from the start on that first phone call. They don't mind it, you call. It's fine. Hey, I gave you something, you give me, you know, 1 minute of your time.
Sure.
As long as you don't oversell it, that'll be a good thing for the next interaction, which might be us sending them an email, might be a call in 3 months from now.
Okay.
When they download the next guide, whatever it is. But I think that's also hugely important. And I think because we came from more of a product-centered culture and not like a sort of sales shark mentality culture, I think we built all these sort of marketing tracks in the way that we would want to be handled, I think, rather than like forcefully sold to.
Yeah.
And I think that helped. We've got a lot of organic leads and organic customers and a lot of word of mouth because of that. Now we have a sales team. And they're up to, this is a new thing within like the last 8 months, and that's really helped us accelerate growth. But, you know, what they do is they look at the lead pool, and people will actually say, I want to hear from you. So there's like, you know, when they're actually downloading a guide, there'll be a checkbox that says, I want to hear more. And so we're already like way down the path of that relationship. And a lot of times they already have read the guide and they know more about fundraising or they know more about what we do. So the inbound strategy is an educational strategy as well.
And the time sale must be a lot easier.
Exactly. By the time you get on the phone, they actually know what you're saying and the value prop. You know, so I think it's worked, you know, really, really well.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
Really,
I love that.
To hear. Well, Scott, thanks so much for coming on here and sharing this with us. Tell us, where can we keep up with you and Stay Classy online?
Twitter, Quora. I love Quora.
Okay. So, what's your handles on that?
Just at Scott Chisholm. So
okay.
SCOTCHISHOLM.
And we'll
sure
link to it too.
Name there. And then, you know, you can follow the Stay Classy Twitter account, whatever else for news. We do, this isn't just fundraising. We do all sorts of like social effects, sort of events and stuff with the community here in San Diego and in San Francisco. A lot of us are on different boards of nonprofits or involved in social enterprise incubators and things like that. So anything social enterprise, nonprofits, you know, come look us up.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Rocket Ship Podcast. If you haven't yet, pop open iTunes and subscribe to be notified of future episodes. We have some really great ones lined up.
And while you're there, leave us a review. We really appreciate each and every one of them. I don't want to write this down. I want to tell you how I feel right now. I don't want to take no time to write this down. I want to tell you how I feel right now. Hey, tomorrow may never be.